Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. The LaRouche Show is a weekly audio talk show broadcast live on the internet every Saturday, featuring interviews with Lyndon LaRouche, his associates, and special guests. And we have some very special guests today. This is your host, Michelle Steinberg, from the Counterintelligence Desk of EIR. And today we'll have a special roundtable edition of the show, which will address the critical issues of the economy. In the United States, it is a mess. Today is December 28th, the day that 1 million Americans are losing their unemployment benefits because of the inaction of the United States Congress, which fled Washington on November 22nd after their short-lived lame duck session, fled Washington rather than face the tough issues and the tough questions that we from the LaRouche movement were bringing to the Capitol. Today I'm happy to welcome two of the nation's leading state elected officials who are well known for not cutting and running from the tough issues. First, State Senator Joe Neal of Nevada, welcome, and Representative Harold James of Pennsylvania. Thank you for being on. Are you there?
Yes, this is Senator Neal. It's a pleasure to be a part of this program this morning.
And this is Harold James on the East Coast from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I'm glad to be here.
Great. Also, my co-host is Harley Schlanger, the West Coast representative of Lyndon LaRouche's presidential campaign. And Harley is one of the coordinators of the organizing for the LaRouche Youth Movement, which is a revolutionary force inside the United States. We're going to have Quincy O'Neill and Michelle Lerner. Michelle is from Philadelphia also. Quincy is from the West Coast, usually, but is doing some special organizing in Texas. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Good.
Okay. I'd like to bring you all up to date on an issue that was the center of our discussion last week, the Israeli elections. There's a miracle in the works, believe it or not, in a horrendous situation in the Middle East of war, threatened war, and assassinations that are going on an unprecedented basis by the Israeli Defense Forces. But if we make that miracle happen, we could be seeing, within 1 month from today, the defeat of war criminal Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his Likud slate. This Sharon government, which has been carrying out the systematic genocide against the Palestinian people in what can only be called an ethnic cleansing operation, Sharon's government is now exposed in a crime, bribery, money laundering, and corruption scandal of massive proportions. Prostitutes, payoffs, money laundering, blackmail were among the tactics used to elect a leadership of the Likud. We at EIR have been briefing people for years about Ariel Sharon and the Israeli mafia, and among other things, how this network of the Israeli mafia killed the only peace candidate in recent period, former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. But now, these thugs are going to jail under the authority of the Israeli government itself. Three members of the Likud Party Central Committee this week have already been arrested. Sharon's son, Omri Sharon, is wanted for questioning, and this could bring down the whole neoconservative apparatus in the United States, the Chicken Hawk warmongers faction around Dick Cheney, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, etc. So that neocon apparatus in the United States and their allies in the Christian right, they call themselves the Christian right, but they are about the most unchristian political force that I have ever seen. They could go down with this gang of thieves. But best of all, there's an alternative. The Labor Party candidate for Prime Minister, General Amram Mitzna, has been the mayor of the city of Haifa. He's revived the hope of peace in the Israeli-Arab negotiations, not for 3 years from now, but now. Mitzna is a man who already 20 years ago was opposing Sharon inside the Israeli military because of Sharon's murderous tactics. And now EIR, with Lyndon LaRouche at the lead, are calling on U.S. President George Bush to show some real courage. And instead of closing the door, slamming the door on the Labor candidate Mitzna, who is the next potential prime minister, LaRouche is telling Bush, don't capitulate to Sharon's blackmail. Look at the new alternative. Meet with Mitzna at the highest level. Get him some briefing so that we can go for peace and not a horrendous war situation. So that about sums up some of the developments on this. But let's look at it from the standpoint of the Iraq war. By going after the secret agenda behind this unnecessary Iraq war, we have been able to, through Mr. LaRouche's activities, take the lead in jamming up the war, which if we had not done that, I could tell you we would already be 3 to 6 months into a Middle East war. But by putting that on the back burner, we can now focus on one of the most important things for the welfare of this country, the economic situation. And that's what I want to ask our guests to talk about today and provide the kind of intellectual leadership that our Congress did not show before they ran out of town. But let's get to the point. Some of the parameters. More than 40 states have deficits as high as $35 billion. That's what California is looking at right now, a deficit of $35 billion. Many states are either in already or are going into emergency hearings about the shortfalls. And what are they taking up? All they're discussing is, what are we going to cut? Cut jobs, cut education, cut infrastructure. But we have to have another alternative. That's what Senator Neal, Representative James, Harley Schlanger have been involved in. And let's start with you, Senator Neal. You fought against energy deregulation. Tell us what is going on in Nevada and what we're going to be seeing as an alternative to the cuts.
Well, the state of Nevada is part of that group of states that is suffering a deficit. And at the present time, we are being told by fiscal people that our deficit is right at approximately $800 million, and we expect that to continue to grow because we do not go into session until February the 3rd, according to our Constitution. However, our money committees, both in the Assembly and the Senate, we will be meeting earlier, starting the 21st of January, to try to look at some of these particular issues. The proposals that we have on the table last year in the state of Nevada to correct the deficit situation in terms of new taxes, the governor has proposed to add a state business activity tax, which is commonly known as a gross receipts tax, which would bring in approximately $250 million. Admission and amusement tax of 6.5%, which bring in approximately $90 million, a property tax increase of about 10% on per $100 assessed valuation, which would bring in approximately $62 million, and cigarettes excess taxes increase of 35 cents per pack, which would bring in $60 million, and a passive revenue generators, that is those efforts to increase the efficiency in collecting those taxes which have not been collected. They estimated that is about $21 million. And we also have the sin tax, which they plan to add about 70% increase on the liquor and tobacco. Of course, we have, you know, this being a gambling state, we have a slot route, a group that is not part of the mega casinos out here. And therefore, they are proposing that they increase their taxes about $5 million, in which estimated that would bring in approximately $500 million. But what is actually happening now As far as the gross receipts tax, which is the largest portion of the tax of the governor's budget, which is $250 million, major commerce organizations, Chamber of Commerce organization, North and South, in Reno and Las Vegas area, opposed to this. And so what we are going to get down to in terms of this particular session coming up is a debate as to who is going to pay. As you notice, that other than the slot rock tax, we did not say anything about gaming. And it's my position that gaming is going to have to step up and pay for some of the costs that they engender by bringing in additional tourists. And why those tourists are here in this state, they are temporary residents utilizing resources such as water, police protection, health care, roads, etc. And when we do not collect the money from those entities to pay for those costs for the tourists, then the cost of that falls upon the base population of about 2 million people in this state. So that's essentially where we are right now in trying to correct this situation. As you might have noticed, that in my discussion of this issue, we had not mentioned anything about infrastructure needs should be given, you know, in terms of trying to correct this situation as a whole. But I don't think we have people, but a few people in this state that's actually thinking, you know, about the infrastructure needs that that will be needed to support, you know, any further monetary resources in terms of added productivity within the state, other than they look at it from the standpoint of building another gaming house. And, of course, gaming is one that takes a lot of money, because for each 8,000 individuals that you have employed in a hotel, a casino, the state has to provide approximately $4.5 million in service to those individuals. So there's no other industry that I know of exact that type of cost. And so it's this session coming up, we're going to be dealing with those particular issues. And, of course, I had served on the money committee, but since we did not have any money to spend, I've taken myself off of that committee and put myself on the taxation committee, because I want to have a front row seat and seeing how, you know, we're going to deal with some of these issues.
You mentioned the question of infrastructure, and I know you have been involved in town meetings and different discussions with Mr. Lyndon LaRouche. I believe both you and Representative James had a hand in the Democratic platform, independent platform hearings, I guess in the year 2000, where we were anticipating some of these issues. What can you tell us about a Roosevelt approach? If there were open ears, how would we get this through? How are we going to do that? Because
well, one of the things that you're going to have to look at infrastructure needs. You're going to have to re-regulate many of your industries, such as your electrical industry, your transportation industry, your telephone industry, your healthcare industries, which all have been deregulated, you know, since the beginning of the 1970s. And we are now suffering as a result of that, because you have no control. And for one instance, to give you an example of we had a special session out here to try to resolve some problems between the doctors and the lawyers in terms of malpractice insurance. And we went into session, the state, a couple of days, and what we saw, it was not a three-part discussion on the part of the doctors and the lawyers and the insurance company, but it was just the doctors and the lawyers. The insurance company kind of stood along the sideline and said, okay, whatever you guys work out is fine with us, because we're going to raise your premium anyway. And so as a result, we do not have any control over the insurance company, and most states do not, mainly because back in the 70s when we brought about ERISA, we gave the authority, with the exception of Hawaii, the authority of the insurance companies to regulate themselves. But it's only in the state of Hawaii that the state has that responsibility. And so Congress, in a sense, you know, failed the public in not allowing the states to be able to impose regulations in terms of premiums, increased premiums, on insurance companies. So as a result, many of the states, such as Nevada, now is suffering because they cannot do anything. And of course, the doctors are saying that they want a cap put on the malpractice, and they put it on the lawyers, and the lawyers arguing back and forth with the doctors, and the insurance companies just sitting there in the easy chair with the legs crossed and laughing at both of them.
Wait,
Senator
Neal, you brought up this question of the Congress, and I'd like to ask Representative James of from his standpoint in Pennsylvania, both what does the crisis look like in Pennsylvania, and what measures are you talking about to try to address the national crisis? Because clearly states are limited as to what they can do to generate revenues, but the federal government has the capability, and this is what LaRouche has been talking about with the Super TVA, to generate credit so that states can build infrastructure. So, Representative James, can you give us a quick picture of the Pennsylvania crisis, and then also any discussion or initiatives you may be taking to bring the Congress to recognize that they have to act on this?
Well, that is something, bring Congress to react. I mean, they didn't even act on the unemployment, which they should have, at least for the sake of the people, have stayed in whatever extra days they needed to stay in to allow for the unemployment extension. So we don't know what we're going to do about Congress, except maybe change a lot of Congress people.
Good start.
Yes.
The other thing, and remember, put some LaRouche Democrats in there, right? I think
sure.
That would. But anyway, in terms of Pennsylvania, I think the message, I was at a meeting last week with the Schiller Institute and going over to Pennsylvania TVA, Super TVA, and as LaRouche describes it, I think that's exactly what we need in order to rejuvenate the economy. Because in Pennsylvania, we're talking about, I remember seeing a document a couple of weeks ago saying that we project a $433 million revenue shortfall, and they're saying that that estimate is probably low when it was added to the $1.8 billion and the one-time funding fixes that we fixed for the current year. So if you add all that up, it comes to about $2.2 billion in the hole. So so of course they're talking about now having some kind of $270 million spending freeze. They're talking about drawing additional $50 million from the rainy day fund. I didn't know if any money was even left in the rainy day fund. And then need another $91 million to make up the difference. So of course we decided, you know, in our infinite wisdom, to open the state stores or some state stores on Sunday for about 4 or 5 hours, and I don't know how much they hope to make up with that. I don't know what that's going to create, but unless they do what LaRouche talked about in terms of trying to do that train or that super TVA structure, it's not going to change. Enough's going to change. So, and looking at the young people that's involved in the LaRouche movement, what I hope to do and hope that we can be meeting with our transportation committee to look at trying to bring up that super TVA so that we can have some rebuilding of the infrastructure. As Senator Neal talked about, there's no discussion about infrastructure. And I'm really surprised because I thought since Nevada was, all the gambling was out there, and now that Rendell is going to be the new governor and there's going to be some gambling things over here in Pennsylvania, that would solve our deficit, but it don't seem like that's working or going to work. So I think that the only thing we left with, the only alternative, is the super TVA that LaRouche is proposing.
Well, if I may, just to Senator Neal, throw another question to you. You and I have traveled to Mexico together and also to Sacramento, California, to discuss the problems that have been caused by deregulation of power in California. But as you mentioned, virtually everything has been deregulated. Now, one of the things that we discussed, that Lyndon LaRouche has proposed, is that the only way a super TVA program could work is if you first have a re-regulation so that states don't take whatever new credit is generated and use it to pay old debt or just pass it over to the energy pirates and so on. So, Senator Neal, if you could for a moment, why don't you just, what is the effect of deregulation and why is it necessary that re-regulation be a primary first step?
Well, first of all, when we talk about deregulation of electricity, we're talking about putting something in the hands of the market forces, which is a necessity for your public. And energy is necessary, you know, to the industrial development of the nation, also taking care of its people in terms of production of goods and things of that sort, hospital care and all that. So we just can't do without it. And it's wrong to take a resource such as that and put it out on the open market and have it subject to the ups and downs of the market, because what you actually doing then is to affecting the creativity of your public, and you do not allow them to become a part of your government as such. And what you do, you create a pyramid situation where your wealth begins to transfer upward into pyramid type, and nothing is flowing at the bottom. And then you find that people begin to try to rob the bottom tier, as you've seen in many of the investment funds, you know, where I think it was that old motion picture about Wall Street, that greed is good, where he traveling along that particular road where we seem to want to accept anybody who can make a buck, but consider how the dollar is made. And if the dollar is made to the disadvantage of your people, then there should be some type of corrective measure. And this is what deregulation of your industry has done, because it affects your main arteries of productivity. Say your deregulation of the railroads that occurred, the airlines, and what happens, they then try to go to the most expensive route. Your rail service tend to bypass communities to go where the money is, and as a result, the creativity of those communities that are bypassed are lost, and there's no connection. And when you begin to have all of these things reach a point where there's a disconnection of your population, everybody began to suffer as a result of that. And I think that Mr. LaRouche have explained that very well in some of the documents that I have seen and read, that the effects of all of this, and you don't have to be a genius, you know, to be able to look at this and discern exactly what's happening.
All you have to do is look at the state of California.
Yes,
well, you know,
California.
For the listeners, Senator Neal and I were in Sacramento in January 2001, where we warned the governor of California through his top energy people that deregulation was going to create a catastrophe for the state. And they kept saying, well, what other options are there? But really, at this point, there's no other option, is there, except re-regulate.
Re-regulation is the only option that you have. You have to do that. It's a must. Because if you don't re-regulate, you have no control over what's going to happen. And if you're going to be charged, if the government's state governments is going to be charged with directing the economy and trying to create a good economy for the people, then they have to have that authority.
Okay, I'd like to see if Quincy or Michelle has a question for Senator Neal. He's going to be having to leave the show, and we can get to Representative James after that. Do one of you want to go ahead?
Sure. Senator Neal, this is Quincy O'Neill from the Los Angeles field. As we make our trips to the legislature in Sacramento, which are becoming a regular, I guess regular happening, we find often that our the national issues which we bring to the legislature, it's as if the things we are telling them don't compute. Mm-hmm. And they understand the state problems that they have, but I'm wondering how you deal with people, or how we could deal with these legislators who don't understand how their state is a state, but it's within the nation, and therefore they are subject to national problems.
Well, and one of the things that you have to do, it's an educational process, but the approach, I think, would be from pointed out to the legislators that their population is going to suffer, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, if their population is going to suffer, that means that chances are, if the guy wants to keep his position and stay there, he's going to have to do something, you know, to prevent that from happening, or try to correct that particular situation. Now, there's the LaRouche group has a knowledge base there that is not enjoyed by many of the legislators that operate, you know, in the various legislatures throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have to try to convince the individuals, you know, about what is happening. And if you can show things that's going to touch them, then you can get their attention, and then you can, you know, impress upon them, you know, what the general needs are. And most legislators, in my experience of the last 31 years of being associated with, do not think in terms of the general welfare. They are parochial in their viewpoint, and they fail to look at the broader picture. And sometimes you can just hand them, you know, a copy of the preamble to the U.S. Constitution,
right,
and say, look, this is what the government is supposed to be about. And we have gotten away from these documents, such as, you know, protecting the general welfare. Unless we do that, you see, everybody suffers as a result of that. And then you can, you know, can point out, you know, such thing as the Enron situation, the collapse of that, and how that effect had the effect of a whole nation, because we did not regulate, you know, that industry properly, or the accounting industry firm that was associated with them, how they were let loose upon the public, and money became the primary objective rather than protecting, you know, the general welfare of our citizens.
Thank you, Senator Neal. We're going to take a short break here for identification.
And I'm going to leave you now, and I have to run.
Thank you. Please come back soon.
Okay.
See you soon in California, Senator.
And give me a call on that hotel, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, you are listening to the LaRouche Show. That was Nevada State Senator Joe Neal, who has been fighting on the fight of reversing deregulation. And we are joined with also by Pennsylvania State Representative Harold James, a former chairman of the Black Caucus in the Pennsylvania legislature, and he will be speaking later on. We also have Harley Schlanger, Western State spokesman for Lyndon LaRouche's campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2004. You can reach us live during this broadcast to ask a question at the toll-free number at 866-857-4327. At all other times when we're not on the air, please call to reach us at 1-888-EIR-3258. Or you can email your question today, and we will get back to you if we don't get you on the air today. But email your questions to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. So let's go back to this discussion. I'd like to ask the next question to Representative James. I remember when Tom Ridge, who's now the Secretary of Homeland Defense, was your governor in Pennsylvania, and he started those cuts, and that was supposed to solve the deficit question, and now you've revealed that you're more than $2.2 billion further in the hole than even back at when he cut the state health care. Let's put the same question on the floor for Pennsylvania. What can be done there to take up the question of this major state, major industrial state or former industrial state, as part of the national economy? What do you have planned?
Well, as I indicated before, you know, in looking at this, the only thing that really I think can be planned, at least the only feasible thing that I heard that's going to make it a re-industrialized state again, is something like the Super TVA. And hopefully that we can start working that out and bring up grassroots, swell the grassroots popularity so that we can get people from one end of the state, from, you know, Pittsburgh area to the Philadelphia area, you know, to get with the legislators and get with our committees to say this is what we need. I think that we ought to probably bring in union people. Union people would be, I think, would be grateful for, you know, wanting to create or rebuild the infrastructure. So I think that's one way to go. I mean, I haven't heard of anything else more feasible and more workable and more doable, because what they've been doing before hasn't been working, as in the welfare cuts that Rich did.
Mm-hmm.
So the welfare cuts have led us now to him becoming the chief security officer for the United States.
Representative James, I know recently you had the opportunity on several occasions to interact with members of the LaRouche Youth Movement in Pennsylvania. One of them is on the phone with us, Michelle Lerner from the Philadelphia office. And Michelle, I wonder if you have a question or some comments for Representative James.
Yeah, well, you just mentioned the idea of a grassroots type movement. And what I was thinking about was, what are your thoughts in terms of public outreach? You know, most outreach that I hear on the radio during these campaigns are, you know, one senator or one, really any type of politician who's competing against another politician to get elected. They just say, well, this person is bad because of this. And then the other one comes on with a commercial right afterwards saying, well, no, he's bad because of this. And there's not much positivity coming out of any type of advertisement campaign. And of course, for a republic to work effectively, the population has to act as citizens. And a big problem that I find today is that a lot of people say, well, I'm just not political. And I think that's a contradiction, because if you're a human being and you observe laws, then you're necessarily political, especially if you're living in a republic, and especially if that republic is shaped for the promotion of the general welfare. What are you thinking in terms of, you know, educating the public in order to get people more on track with the type of solution we need to get across, so that people can actually go out and lobby their legislators and representatives? If you can comment on that.
Well, I think that you guys seem to be, have started the snowball to rolling, and all I got to do is keep rolling down the hill. As you pick up other youth members and your cavalry of proceeding to make sure that everybody is educated and informed. Because I think that as you talk about one politician talking about another politician, I think that the elected officials or politicians that want to proceed can't get caught up into that negativity, because, as you say, it turns off the voting and the frustration. That's why if you look at our voting activity from the voting public, you can see that the voting activity has been going down, the percentage of people actually voting. So it's a turnoff. So we need to, if we have that, the young people continuing their grassroots efforts of meeting with legislators, holding town meetings, holding community meetings, getting other young people involved, I think can the snowball would have a, continue to have a snowball effect as to get people encouraged and enthused about the fact of, hey, we need an infrastructure rebuilding so that we can create more opportunities, job opportunities, and people paying more taxes.
Good, thanks. But is it possible that there would be hearings, open hearings, not just a town meeting, but the prestige of the legislature itself? Do you think we could push something like that through?
That's possible. That's why I said that, you know, if we proceed through, like, one, the Transportation Committee, as the fact that the Transportation Committee is hesitant because the Republicans control the agenda, we can definitely try to implement it through some our Democratic Policy Committee, who is controlled by us, in terms of us holding some type of hearings. Of course, it would be better if the hearings was held by an established committee.
I have an indication here on our from our organizers' conference line that one of the participants in that has a question for Representative James. Okay, that silence sounds like a technical glitch.
Well, Michelle, I have
I apologize.
Sort of a comment and a question.
Go ahead.
Maybe Representative James could comment on this, and also Quincy. Because one of the things that we've been doing on the West Coast in California is taking literally carloads of young people up to talk to legislators. And quite often, the problem you run into is what Senator Neal was talking about, the parochial view, where you go in and you talk to someone about, look what effects these budget cuts are going to have. And in California, the $35 billion will mean accelerated deaths of especially the elderly, the poor, the unemployed, with the shutdown of health care and things of this sort. And so one of the things we're finding is that people keep saying, well, look, we can't deal with it. All we can do is cut. And there seems to be a blindness to the role that a legislator has as a spokesman for his constituents to be able to bring in a national perspective and hold the Congress's feet to the fire. What do you think about that, Harold?
Well, I mean, I would imagine, you know, and I know for a fact that there are certainly a number of legislators that would be hesitant, you know, to reach out or stretch out. But I think, you know, in my view, in my district, we talk about, if I can say that, hey, we're going to create or work on an infrastructure that's going to give job opportunities for people in terms of rebuilding the infrastructure, then people would have an opportunity to work, and that's definitely what most people would want. So I just think that they have to be convinced that this is the best opportunity in order to create the economic development, because all of us as politicians talk about economic development, that we want it in our own districts. And who would not want economic development in the district? I mean, I don't think that the liquor store on Sunday is going to get economic development.
Or like you said, the gambling. I mean, here was Nevada, the gambling state. That's supposed to be the cure-all for everything. Riverboat gambling in Indiana, Mississippi, et cetera.
All those things do is require more police protection.
Right, and that costs more money. Okay, we have that question from the conference call to Representative Harold James. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, a question from Ann in Nevada. Are there any plans to introduce into Pennsylvania legislation for infrastructure?
There was a plan that I think there is a plan that I saw demonstrated at the Schiller Institute meeting that I was at, and I sure would like to help and work on working on it.
Great. Michelle, can you tell us what that was? Are you familiar with the specific Schiller initiative has been?
Well, there's been a videotape floating around for I don't know how many years. It's not brand new, and specifically dealing with building a maglev train line from Philadelphia through Harrisburg and through Pittsburgh. Right now, taking the highways, it takes about 6 hours to get from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. But as demonstrated on this videotape that we watched at the town hall meeting, it would take only 90 minutes to get from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. And, of course, you know, all of the added benefits of building an infrastructure project as such would require opening up the steel mills, which, you know, Bethlehem Steel and Pennsylvania has been completely decimated with the steel workers because we have higher quality steel, but yet so much is being imported that it's actually undermining all of the work that we had here. So they've been going through massive cuts, and you know, that type of program will actually put things in a clearer perspective in terms of getting back to a producer society. And I think that's what Representative James is referring to, the idea of building a maglev train line from Philadelphia through Harrisburg and Pittsburgh.
That's correct.
Well, there's an interesting event taking place in a couple of days in China. The one country in the world that's actually building a maglev line is China, and it will be going from Shanghai to the Shanghai airport, and the Germans won the contract, and German Chancellor Schroeder will be on that maiden voyage that will be taken. I think it's on New Year's
Day.
Now,
the Germans won the contract in China.
Yeah.
No, I believe it's December 31st is what I heard on that.
All right, so they'll get it started before the new year, and what Lyndon LaRouche was saying over the weekend is that this gives a capability now, or a demonstration, that in China, at least, people are thinking about the future, and that this is maybe a wake-up call to the rest of the world. I'd like to ask Quincy for his thoughts on something, because...
Well, tell me, what's the distance on that in China, on that train?
It's, I think, about 28 or so miles.
Okay.
But what they're talking about now is following that up with a maglev route that will go between Shanghai and the capital of Beijing, which is about 2,000 kilometers, which is closer to 1,200, 1,300 miles.
Mm.
So the potential for this is just enormous. Of course, on the West Coast, they always talk about the need to build one between Los Angeles and Las Vegas, mm-hmm. as opposed to taking one up the coast.
Well, Harley, what Mr. LaRouche was saying in our intelligence evaluation yesterday about that Shanghai thing is it's a pilot project.
Right.
And he was reflecting on, you know, his days as a young guy in World War II and so forth when Franklin Roosevelt was president, that's just how the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, worked. They would do a pilot project, and once it worked, once it was feasible, then, you know, the sky's the limit. And that, you know, that would be really a beautiful, optimistic thing if we could. If that's not even covered on anywhere in the United States media that such a thing exists. So we're dealing with a ignorance from the top that we can address by the kind of snowball effect that our organizing is doing, and it's the only way.
Well, I think in that context, it's just worth noting that what Lyndon LaRouche has been discussing and what Representative James described as the snowball effect of the youth movement. Is that, in fact, given the nature of the crisis, it's not just state deficits. It's a federal deficit that could be $500 billion this year. It's nations such as Brazil that are being destroyed, Argentina destroyed. Africa has already been decimated by the global systemic crisis. And so in this context, the only way to force a discussion of these kinds of issues, nationally and internationally, is through recruiting youth who otherwise seem to have, or not seem to have, but have no future. And Quincy, you want to say a couple words about how this is working on the West Coast, and especially how it's deploying, in a sense, in the state level, but really it's an international deployment.
For sure. We, since I've joined on the West Coast, we've more than doubled our membership there. It's a fight that we wage on the campuses and on the streets, getting people to realize their responsibility and how they won't make it. I mean, as LaRouche said to the people in Peru at a cadre school, I mean, that's some of the international side of it. These gatherings have been happening in Paris and Germany and in Mexico. And he said, listen, my presidential campaign, my leadership is the only leadership that will solve this crisis. And that's it. It won't work otherwise. We won't make it. Conveying that is what recruits people to the movement. Once someone understands that that is the case, how grave the economic crisis is, the kind of responsibility that we have in the United States, we're the only people that can participate in this political process, and that there are people who care, that there are people who are willing to step forward and be out in front, like Lyndon LaRouche. That's what people are responding to. And, that's kind of what we're working on here in Houston, and which is continuing to expand throughout the country.
Well, I have a question on that international snowball. As you know from our briefings every day, Lyndon LaRouche has been holding cadre schools with the youth in Mexico, Peru, Europe. Are you and Michelle also involved in that international organizing of the youth movement?
We are. There are international calls that are made, we get on those often. And I haven't been on one myself, but I know we have those every week. And since we have members, my friend Sam Dixon is in Germany right now. Elodie, who is responsible for a lot of the French work, was originally part of the California local, and we have a regular exchange with Mexico. So directly and indirectly, certainly are participating.
Wow, an international Republican, yeah, with a small R movement. And I think, Harold, you have been in politics for quite some time. You mentioned the fall off in voting, which has been devastating. And what we've seen is part of the problem is these Democratic candidates wanted to be more Bush than Bush, and the country doesn't need two Republican parties. What do you think the youth movement would have as an effect on reviving the Democrats?
Well, I think the youth movement can have a couple of effects. One, not only reviving and revitalizing the Democrats, but reviving and revitalizing voters. People around the concerns of what's going to help them economically. We've been talking about political empowerment. We've been talking about, minority involvement, and we've been talking about all of those things and doing something about it. But I think now that we're talking about it is we need economic stability, and we don't have that. That's why, everything after 9/11, it just seemed that, all the money went towards war-type things, and now they're leading up to that because they think war-type actions is going to promote the economy. So we need to do other than that, and we need to deal with infrastructure, as LaRouche points out, and I think that's the best way. So I think if the young people will continue to do what they're doing, try to recruit more young people, try to organize to get more young people involved, and one of the key things that young people and organizing and meeting with this legislator is they got to get young people within the respective legislator's district to be with them as they meet with them.
Mm-hmm. And Representative James, your sense is that having a flow of young people coming up to the legislature does get the attention of legislators.
Yes. They respond to young people. They want to get that appearance that they enthused about them if they're not. But if they are from the districts, they will give that. They will do that. At least one of them.
I had a question for Representative James. Lyndon LaRouche and his discussions around the world has discussed the question of sublime leadership, which he's an example of, and that only that kind of leadership, people willing to step out in front, go against popular opinion, only that kind of leadership will suffice given this crisis. I'm wondering, how do you plan to provide that kind of leadership? We have 13 months to the Democratic primary. Do you have any plans of organizing other representatives and stepping out in front?
Well, I don't have any plans as of yet. I think after the meeting I was at, I had gave some suggestions at what the young people could or should do. And then because I would start the process, and the process is is to put something in writing to address the committee to see what they do. And if they don't do, then we, you know, we'd file another action. And I think that we just got to, at least that's the way I would go about it.
I'd like to make a comment. Michelle had brought up this question of the Democratic Party being more like a new Republican Party. And what, at this point, what you notice is that both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, have strayed away from what is truly American. And that characteristic of an American system of economics is truly what Lyndon LaRouche himself embodies, coming directly from the tradition of Leibniz, Benjamin Franklin. And he has emphasized this question of the sublime leadership and put himself in that light from the standpoint of Benjamin Franklin, specifically in the American tradition, who was the leader organizing at the time of the American Revolution. So what the question really is, you know, not which party is better at this point. They're both, you know, there's absolutely lacking leadership throughout the entire nation. The question is, who's going to be brave enough to actually come out with this American spirit, which is, as Joniel was saying, the question of the general welfare of the population. You know, it's unique to the American spirit that we put that we are the people that pertain to the government in that relationship, that are by the people, for the people. So that is the unique leadership of Lyndon LaRouche in this time of a crisis, specifically because of this question of his unique understanding of economics from the standpoint of American system economics. So I just wanted to put that out on the table as a comment in addition to what Quincy was saying on the question of the sublime leadership, and also this issue of the, you know, the Democratic Party posing itself as being more Bush than Bush.
Well, it's interesting. I was on a radio show in Hot Springs, Arkansas a couple of days ago, and one of the things I reviewed is the complete collapse of business as usual in the country. You have the Trent Lott situation, and of course, while Lott is an open expression of the Southern strategy, we haven't completely gotten rid of the Southern strategy yet by any means, but also the fall of Gore, the fall of Kissinger, and then the cleaning out of the economic advisors to the president, the Lindsay O'Neill resignations, and now Kenneth Dam and John Taylor from the Treasury Department, two of the top officials, they're going. And after discussing this, there was a woman who called in, and she said, I was thinking, with all these people leaving or being kicked out, wouldn't this be a good time for President Bush to bring in Lyndon LaRouche? And, of course, that's what I would have said from the beginning myself, but getting that from a woman in Hot Springs, Arkansas, led me to think that, in fact, this is the time where we can have those kinds of bold changes where, whether it's Republican or Democrat, one of the things that Lynn said in his recent Thanksgiving Day message is he called to mind the great American system thinker, Matthew Carey, the ally of Benjamin Franklin, the publisher of Franklin, who wrote a book during a time of crisis about 1810, 1812, called The Olive Branch, where he said it's time to put nation, the real national interests, ahead of the partisan interests. We've got a long way to go to get there, but I think with people like Representative James, Senator Neal, and others providing leadership on these issues, I think now is a time where we have that potential, unlike any period in the recent past in this country.
Well, Harley, I wanted to let everybody know that I have invited Mr. LaRouche for next Saturday to be on the LaRouche Show, and so far the answer is positive, pending final checks on the schedule. And this would be the first time that Mr. LaRouche has had a dialogue with the whole country in this way since October 19th, when he really called the shots and said that after the election, the front and center crisis would become economics, and that's what it is. So I hope that everybody who's listening today will make this audience 10 times as big as it is today, the biggest audience ever on the LaRouche Show, and get questions in. Representative James, I'm going to give you the last question that we have and see if we have any time after that. But this is an email that came in from Kansas City, Missouri, a listener called Gus. Topic, when will mainstream politicians acknowledge the Depression? And this listener says, I see the economic storm clouds gathering momentum. When will we see the mainstream politicians acknowledge this busted economy? Are torches and pitchforks in our near future?
Well, it appears that way. Torches and pitchforks are in there, unless we can find the end of the rainbow. But but I think that what happens is that we have to rejuvenate our economy. We might have to do it at one legislator at a time or several legislators at a time in several states. You have to organize a mechanism and ability to create that. And I think, and by doing it one at a time, or if we did it one at a time, because the mainstream legislators or politicians are not going to do nothing until they're effectively challenged by someone who proposes the true or the true economic development that's perceived by the constituency in which they serve. So if you can if you have a groundswell of young people and people from that constituency, you know, and then you have somebody who's challenging the incumbent that's in there and saying they're not about true economic development, and this person is, I think that's what's going to do it. It was something similar to what Wofford did here when he ran for Senate and won. Because on one issue, which was health care.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, for some reason, the Democrats let that die down, all because they was afraid of a woman such as Hillary leading that charge, at, you know, when she did, and challenging them senators, so they had to, like, put her back in her place, I guess.
You know, but, Harold, something similar happened in Louisiana, where mm-hmm. Landrieu in the Senate race, who had been running this pro-Bush Democratic campaign, mm-hmm. last week of the campaign, last 10 days, shifted to attacking free trade because of the effects of the free trade policy destroying Louisiana sugar growers, and she came from falling behind, she came back ahead and won the race on the basis of saying, we're going to have fair trade, we're not going to accept this free trade.
Okay, well, that's good. And, you know, unfortunately, the lady, Kennedy lady in Maryland, missed it.
Right.
Yeah.
We are out of time. Thank you. All. Thank you, especially Harold James and
Thank
our
you.
Young people. Come back again.
Okay. Keep the cavalry moving.
Thank you.